All right, Nehemiah, looking at Nehemiah and his return to Jerusalem. We really get into that more in chapter 2 here and the work that he has before him and how he's leading the people of God in this work. So let's begin Nehemiah 2. Let's read verses 1 through 10. 1 through 10. Who would like to get that for us? Nehemiah 2, 1 through 10. Ron.
1 through 10. And it came to pass in a month of Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, the king, that wine was before him, and I took up the wine and gave it unto the king. Now I had not been before time sad in his presence. Wherefore the king said unto me, Why is thy countenance sad, seeing that thou art not sick? There is nothing else but sorrow of heart. And I was very sore afraid. I said unto the king, Let the king live forever. Why should not my countenance be sad, when the city, the place of my father's sepulchres, lieth waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire? Then the king said unto me, For what dost thou make request? So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said unto the king, If it please the king, and if thy servant have found favor in thy sight, that thou wouldest send me unto Judah, unto the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may build it. And the king said unto me, the queen also sitting by him, For how long shall thy journey be, and what wilt thou, and when wilt thou return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. Moreover, I said unto the king, If it please the king, let letters be given me to the governors beyond the rivers, that they may convey me over till I come unto Judah. And a letter was sent unto Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the palace which appertained to the house, and that the wall of the city and the house that I shall enter into. And the king granted me according to the good hand of my God unto me. Then I came to the governor beyond the river and gave them the king's letter. Now the king had sent captains of the army and horsemen with me. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the servant, the Amorite, heard of it, it grieved them exceedingly that there was come a man to seek the welfare of the children of Israel.
Okay, so it mentions, first of all, there in verse 1, the month in which he had come, Nisan and Abib. The Jewish calendar is around the time of April for us. If you go back to chapter 1, verse 1, and calculate out the time, this is about 4 months later, after he found out the condition of Jerusalem, when the report had come to him about it. And what was it that the king noticed about Nehemiah on this occasion?
He was sad.
Remember, he had been sad when he heard. So this is a four-month thing. 4 months later, it's still weighing heavy on his mind, on his heart. He's thinking about it. And on this particular occasion, it's so overwhelming to him that it shows through to the king. So he evidently had worked to keep this sadness from the king knowing about it. And why might he do that?
The king had enough to worry about. A servant around the king needed to be joyful, but I guess it weighed on his heart so much that he couldn't keep it hidden any longer.
Okay, what does the end of chapter 2 say? The King James, which I believe Ron was reading out of, said sore
afraid.
What are some other translations there at the end of verse 2?
Dreadfully afraid.
Why would he be dreadfully afraid? Why would he be unsettled about the king seeing and noticing he's sad?
Disturbed or
or angered him meant death for the person. It could mean death for the person who did it.
Exactly. They weren't joking around. He's not unsettled here because it's just something that's built up in his head over time, right? There, those ancient potentates, basically whatever they wanted went. And if somebody walked into their presence and displeased them, they could tell their guards standing by, take them and get rid of them. You know, off with their head. And they would do that.
Well, even in the book of Esther, for her to even ask for an audience was possibly a death sentence.
Yes, if she was worried about going in not having been invited, and if he was displeased, she's like, I could die. And that's the queen, right? So he has reason to be nervous here. And if you put those things together, that's probably part of why he held back on being sad around the king. John?
I think there's two points that you can make from this. One is the king relied on him, trusted him, and thought highly of him as a servant. But as a servant, Nehemiah also didn't let that relationship get in the way of what he owed that king, which is to be a humble servant who is fearful for his life, despite the king knowing him in a very personal way, knowing him enough to know when his countenance had fallen.
Right. And he's there to help the king run the kingdom. He's not there to worry about his own personal matters. Right? So exactly right. And so the king does notice it on this occasion. The king asks him why. So the king is observant. He's not oblivious to Nehemiah and his mood, his disposition, his attitude here. So he recognizes this. And Nehemiah, of course, reveals his distress over the city of Jerusalem. This brings us to question number one. What was Nehemiah's attitude toward the work needed at Jerusalem? And what did he do about it? And what does this teach us? So what's his attitude about it? He's sad. Anything else?
Sad, but seriously concerned about it. I mean, it was weighing on his mind so much that he was anxious to get it done.
Okay.
Anxious to see it done.
Do you remember what it said about him in chapter 1 we talked about? What did he do when he found out?
He sat down and he wept and he mourned for days and prayed about it.
There you are. It struck his attitude, so his emotions were affected, but then that led him to praying about it. So he mourned and prayed. And he did something else that really comes out in chapter 2. There's something else he's been doing in these 4 months. What has he been doing? You got to read between the lines a little bit, but you just have to understand this is what's been going on.
He's been planning. You know, he's already thought through, hey, I'm going to need a letter so I can get through into safety, you know, to the land beyond the river type of thing, you know. He's gearing up to strategize how to present it to the king. I think he's caught off guard here, but he's been planning it out in his head for this many months.
Okay.
Well, I'm wondering, is he really caught off guard, or had he finally, at the end of chapter 1, he asked God to help him, you know, find favor with this king? I think he kept his emotions in check until he realized he had to do something, and then he just asked for God to show him mercy through this king. And then he let his feelings show. Because for 4 months, when you see how he took that news, he was obviously not showing that until he asked God to help me with this.
Yeah, I see him as masking it here. Ron, do you have something?
Well, I was just going to say, in addition to that, in verse 4, I thought it was very interesting where he says, and then the king said unto me, for what thou dost thou make, for what dost thou make request? And he says, so I prayed to the God of heaven. So in my mind, I envision him standing there and saying a prayer at that moment, and then he proceeds. But within himself, he is
Okay.
Striving to get that determination to do this.
This is kind of how I picture it. Could be different ways that it just came upon him at this time. He just, okay, today he's just like, wow, it's really weighing on me, and the king noticed that or whatever. I kind of see this as him planning through over these months, and then he's looking for an opportunity. And here's, and today when his sadness is showing and the king asks, he's like, boom, I got to hit it right now, right here. I got to come out with it. So he comes out with it. You know, here's what the issue is, king. But he seizes this opportunity. He wasn't one that had this attitude, well, if I just have the right feeling about Jerusalem, that's all I really need. You know, some people, especially in our society, I think we can see, if they just feel right about a particular thing, well, then they get their gold star and you know, you're a super person. Well, just feeling the right way about something's not good enough. And Nehemiah didn't take that position. He's like, I've got to do something about this. So he told the king. The king asked him, what do you want? And then the question two I ask, getting to Ron's point, what can we learn from Nehemiah's short prayer in 2 verse 4? So how do you picture this prayer? Ron mentioned a second ago, but I just want to bring this into focus. Hey, what do you want? What's Nehemiah do? Say, hold on a second. I'm going to go over here to the other room. I'm going to say a prayer. I'll be right back. What does he do?
He had already prayed.
No, 2 verse 4. King says, what do you want?
I pray. Okay.
And what does he do?
He prays.
Right there on the spot, right in front of the king. So what kind of prayer was it? Hold on.
Right.
Well, he could have at that moment just petitioned God in prayer for wisdom.
Just, okay. Have you all ever done this? And this, I have to do it out loud for you because you won't have any idea, just me standing here, but dear God, please help me. Mm-hmm. It could have been as simple as that. Just in his mind, dear God, please help me. So what can we learn from this short prayer?
When important things are going to happen or getting ready to happen, especially spiritual things, we need to pray about them. And he said this prayer just now, but when you ask what he'd been doing for 4 months, this is evidently one of the things that he'd been doing. He'd been praying about this. And I think it's important to him for also because I think one of the reasons he was scared and he was in danger because he's getting ready to tell the king that he needed something and his mind was on other things. A king may not take that the right way because if you have an employee or somebody in your kingdom that needs something, especially money or time off, you're thinking to those, you might think to himself, well, man, this guy's going to steal from me or he's looking out for his own good, not my good. But I think what he's getting ready to tell the king weighed in that danger that he felt. So his personal safety, but also, more importantly, the spiritual welfare of God's people down there is what he's praying for.
Yeah, he's there getting ready to make a big ask of the king.
Along those lines, he's the cupbearer. So in that, he is trusted.
Okay,
I have to leave.
Hold your thought. We'll get into him and having the weight of this going before the king. I want to focus on this prayer for a minute. When you have the value of a short prayer here, John mentioned one thing. What's he been doing for 4 months? He's been praying. Nehemiah's in the habitual practice of prayer. This was not like an unusual thing for him. And people who are people of prayer, they'll pray at different times, right? So here he is, and it's preceded by months of prayer and planning leading up to this moment. And he's looking to revealing this, asking, the way I see it, with this dreadfully afraid, asking for that strength and success in this appeal that he's getting ready to make before the king. Rick, did you have something real quick?
I was just thinking of the habit of being in prayer, keeping the thought of communication with God always in the front of your mind. And basically, pray without ceasing. That's
right.
The idea, you know.
Right. And back to what we had talked about before, you know, he had asked at the end of chapter 1, you know, grant me mercy in the sight of this man. And here's that exact moment when he needed that mercy most, because it's getting ready to be laid out to him. Now, back to Clint. What's before him here? What are you looking at?
Well, he's, in my mind, he's thinking, all right, I'm about to ask the king, but I need to go. I can't fulfill my job anymore that you have trusted me to do. So now you're going to have to go and trust somebody else, and that's going to take effort and time to figure out who's going to be your next cupbearer, because I'm not going to be here, and I still need your support when I'm not here.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I see Nehemiah kind of stressing about, is how do I approach this? You know, when we say, you know, he said a prayer, I'm thinking that's what he's saying. He's asking God for strength. He's asking God for wisdom to say the right thing so that he can be successful in his plan.
Mm-hmm. Ron?
I think that's precisely what we see in the next verse even, how he phrases his request. He doesn't assert himself. His petition is to the king.
Mm-hmm.
And the king's assessment of everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the king finds favor, and that's that demonstration of the wisdom that God obviously granted him, because as we said earlier, if the king found it to be unacceptable, disfavorable, he could have killed him.
Right. Right then and there. Anything else?
We can also see that a prayer doesn't have to be long to be effective, because he didn't have time to, you know, step aside.
Right.
And do this. It's quick.
Right then and there, quick prayer. Then he begins to lay it out to the king here. So, yeah, exactly. I don't know exactly how to put it in our modern terms. It might be like a chief technology officer, chief financial officer, chief operating officer who goes to the CEO of the company or the owner of the company and says, okay, I've got to leave, and not only that, you know, I'm going to be gone for a good while. Somebody else is going to have to do that job, as Clint was talking about, and I need, like, you know, $100 million to go on this venture, and I need you to write letters to everybody in the company that's a multinational company that's going to say they're going to back me up and give me the resources I need when I get over there. I mean, this is huge for him to go in and ask for the king. So the king recognizes, you know, how long do you have to be gone? So there's going to be a leave of absence here, so to speak. He needs those letters of authority, and he asks for those materials to be given to him so he can accomplish that job. Any other thoughts there? Latter part of verse 8, what does he say? He's laid it all out to him. And what does the record tell us?
The king gave him what he asked him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. According to the good hand of my God upon me.
Okay. He recognized God's working in this. Again, it goes back to that point. God is greater than king, the king here, than Artaxerxes. Now, Artaxerxes, if you're observing this as somebody in the kingdom, you're thinking, oh, Artaxerxes is being very generous and very kind, and Nehemiah could not do this without him. And in one sense, yeah, that's true. But we have to look beyond that, that God is the one that has his hand at work here behind the scenes. And we need to remember that. In our country and other countries, in this state or any other state, the powers that be that God is working in these things, and we don't always understand that working and how it works or connects, but God is working, and God is working on Nehemiah's behalf, who's working in behalf of the children of Israel to help them in their terrible circumstances. Any other thought up to that point?
This is the second time that it's probably the same king that Ezra approached, so this is really the second time that this things have been arranged for somebody to go down there to get things done. That may have been in the back of his mind as well.
He's and going, and part of it might be even, you know, showing me favor over other people, and what kind of thing would that provoke? Because when we get down to the end there, you know, the Sanballat and Tobiah, they do not like what's happening here. But we'll get back to that a little bit later. I want us to think for just a moment, what kind of life did Nehemiah have with the king as the cupbearer? Just paint a picture of his life. What would it have been?
Well, one of servitude, but he evidently found favor in the king. He evidently did his job very well.
Did his job very well, yes. The king had complete confidence in Nehemiah. He would not have granted this and the resources and the army to protect him. You know, he's taken a whole group of soldiers to protect him on the way. That's how much the king thinks of him. It's not like, yeah, Nehemiah, you know, you can go. Good luck, buddy. It's like, here's the letters of authority, here's the resources that you need, and here's the army to accompany you to make sure nobody harasses you along the way and you get there safely. He has complete trust and confidence, great respect for Nehemiah. So what kind of life did Nehemiah have in Shushan?
Pretty plush for a servant, especially. I mean, he was probably treated with the best of what a servant would be treated with. He probably had all that he needed and then some. And, you know.
When we fast forward in the book, we're going to see later where Nehemiah's really wealthy, mm-hmm. very, very wealthy. What kind of home do you think he lived in Shushan? You think he was like down the alley out there with the peasants? No, he lived a great life from the material perspective.
As far as I can tell from verse 1, when Hanani comes to him, it says he's in Shushan, the citadel. Mm-hmm. Right? That's the fortress within the palace type of situation.
Mm-hmm.
He's in it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Let's understand, Nehemiah had servants who were serving him, seeing to his needs. His focus was taking care of the king's business. There are others who are serving Nehemiah in his daily life, taking care of his clothing, his room, his all these things. But he has wealth. He has a very high standard of living. Where's he looking to go?
Well, didn't have electricity and running water there, let's put it that way.
No, but I'm going to tell you right now, the man lived in luxury, for sure. We think we're so sophisticated these days, but he lived well. So where's he getting ready to go?
Where there's no
place that's been basically destroyed, so yeah.
Right, right. It would. To some degree, be like us going from living in the United States of America to going and living in a typical town in Mexico or the Philippines. You're going to the backwoods. You're going somewhere where your life is going to change. Go ahead.
I think that's evident through the text. It is constant. It was even with Ezra. You're going to go to the what? Oh, that land beyond the river. They don't even have a name for it, it seems like. They're just, oh, over there. And the other thing that I was thinking is that, you know, this is the world power of the day.
Superpower, like we can't imagine. Superpower.
So this isn't like going to Argentina and asking the king, you know, in today's world, or the president of Argentina. You know, this is
Right.
This is the superpower giving me what I want.
Yeah, it's really hard for us to comprehend how big of a thing this is. And one of the things he's giving up his daily kind of life of luxury, if you will, even though he is a servant. He's giving that up, but he's also giving up something that I think is even far greater, is that daily interaction with the king. He was there in his presence every day. He had that relationship with him, and you see it was a very good relationship, but he's going to be gone for a good long while now. And he's willing to give that up to go over there and work on something else, something that he saw was of greater value and greater need. So he's going to be away for a while, be away from his home, the palace, the king, and all those things that he had there before. But he was willing to do this and to go and to work hard for the sake of God's people, to help build them up. So something else I want us to think about is this shows that planning and preparation and action are in harmony with prayer. Planning, preparation, action go with prayer. Any other thoughts there? Okay. So again, how the enemies react when Nehemiah showed up? Deeply disturbed, the New King James says. Deeply disturbed that a man had come to seek the well-being of the children of Israel. And I know that the Middle East is different, and the nation of Israel that's there today is not the nation of Israel as it was in the Old Testament or anything like that. But it's just very interesting. Everybody hates anything good that happens to them over there, even to this day, but be that as it may. Let's read 11 through 16. Who will grab that for us? Nehemiah 2, 11 to 16. Go ahead, Mike.
So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. And I arose in the night and a few men with me. I did not tell anyone what my God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem. And there was no animal with me except the animal on which I was riding. So I went out at night by the valley gate in the direction of the dragon's well and onto the refuse gate, inspecting the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were consumed by fire. Then I passed on to the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was no place for my mount to pass. So I went up at night by the ravine and inspected the wall. Then I entered the valley gate again and returned. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done, nor had I as yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the rest who did the work.
Okay, so he goes out to survey the walls when?
In the night.
At night. Okay. Now again, this is just one of those things where I have a distinct picture in my mind that it's totally clear in a full moon, and he's going out. But why would he go out at night? Why wouldn't he just go out in the day?
He didn't want to stir up the anger amongst them. What is it?
Well, within those verses, what does it reveal to us relative to the people who dwelt in Jerusalem?
We know a couple things. One, he had a military escort to take him down there, so there was a need for protection. The people around in the area did not want this to happen, but also the people who were supposed to be doing the work had not done it. So if he goes in the daylight, the foreigners or the Samaritans are going to see it, and the people who were supposed to be doing the work are going to see it, and both parties probably don't want him inspecting the walls because it makes everybody look.
In verse 12, it says, neither told I any man what my God had put in my heart to do. So he is, at this point, keeping it confidential until he surveys and further advances the plan, and then he'll reveal it.
Okay. So it's kind of like this. It's kind of like if we were here in Newton and we lived here and everything, and I don't know, say the Secretary of Defense, who we didn't realize had stepped down, took a leave of absence from his position a couple of months ago, that he shows up in town. It's like, what's he doing here? That's the level Nehemiah is at. And he has now authority in Jerusalem, in Judea. He is there by the king's authority. So it's like he's a governor type of position coming in to rule in this area. And basically, he has the right to run it. He doesn't want to tip his hand yet. He doesn't want to be bothered or disturbed or hangers-on or a bunch of questions. So he goes out at night to survey, and he wants to assess it firsthand. Remember, up to this point, he'd only gotten a report as to the condition of everything. He wants to go out and look at it himself, get eyes on, here's what is really happening, here's what it looks like in this area, go around to the east, this is what it looks like, to the north it looks like this, the west it looks like this. And he's where he had general plans before, he's now assessing to have specific action. What do we actually do here? Where is it that it needs to be built up? How much rubble needs to be cleaned away? Where's the greatest vulnerability? All those kinds of things. So you can see from the practical side why he would go out at night. Now, I asked Nehemiah, question 3, surveyed the walls. What do we need to survey? Okay.
Always our lives and the church.
Any passage to go with our lives? There's a very famous one that starts with examine. Second Corinthians. Okay. We examine ourselves to observe the body and blood of the Lord when we're worshiping. 2 Corinthians 13:5. Examine yourselves. Second Timothy 2:15. But 2 Corinthians 13:5. Examine yourselves.
Show yourself to prove whether you're in the faith.
Yeah. See if you're in the faith. Whether you're in the faith. It's incumbent upon us to look at ourselves. You know, Nehemiah went out to see exactly how things were. He wasn't overlooking it. He wasn't ignoring it. He wasn't saying, well, I know the walls are bad, but he took a thorough examination of it. And we need to examine our lives. Where have we fallen apart, so to speak? Where is the weakness in our life? Where is it that we need to clean things up some? We need to have that self-examination. But then what was the other thing, Rick? You said examine ourselves.
Sorry.
What church?
The church, or the local congregation, I guess would be the way to present it, because we cannot examine the universe.
Yeah, we can't examine the universal church. I mean, we could look out maybe in this land or somewhere we have information about, maybe in this area, and we could examine and say, okay, you know, Churches of Christ in the North Carolina region, it's pretty weak here. Now, you get down in Alabama and there's thick as flies down there. Here, not so much. So you could do that. But more to us, we examine this church and take an honest look at it. You know, are the walls broken down? Is there some cleanup that needs to happen? Things we need to tidy up a bit, build up, strengthen? Yeah, we need to do that. And be honest about it. And not just ignore it, overlook it, or say, I don't want to really see that. You know, let's examine it and have that good, healthy view of it so we know what kind of action needs to be taken. So let's jump forward. Anything up to 16? Don't want to rush too fast, but.
Well, the people were sinning and not getting this done because it was a command found in the book of Ezra that they were to do this, and they had not been doing it.
Yes, exactly right. Let's read 17. Let's just go ahead and finish out the chapter 17 through 20. Who will get that for us?
17 to what?
To 20.
Have thou not proclaimed this unto thyself, in that thou hast forsaken the Lord thy God, when he led thee by the way.
Is this Nehemiah 2, verse 17?
Right. Sorry. Yeah, hold on a second. This might help us a little bit slow here.
Do we need to switch up?
Yeah.
Anybody else? Nehemiah 2, 17. Go, Micah.
Okay, then say I unto them, you see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lie waste, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. Come, and let us build up the wall of Jerusalem, that we be no more a reproach. Then I told them of the hand of my God, which was good upon me, as also the king's word that he has spoken unto me. And they said, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for this good work. But when Sambala the Horonite and Tobiah the Serbent, the Ammonite, and Geshem the Arabian heard it, they laughed us to scorn and despised us and said, what is this thing that ye do? Will you rebel against the king? Then answered I them and said unto them, the God of heaven, he will prosper us. Therefore we his servants will arise and build. But ye have no portion, no right, no memorial in Jerusalem.
Okay. So first thing he does after he examines it is he gets those leaders together and encourages them. He gives a very blunt assessment, first of all, where he says, you know, you see we're in distress. Jerusalem lies in waste. Its gates are burned with fire. Do leaders need to be blunt with people? Look at how this is. And he's not, in this assessment, he's not saying, he's not going after them, so to speak, but you know they've got to feel that pressure of, yeah, it is like that. But he's telling them, look, here's the way that it is. He's not really concerned about them coming back at him with a negative reaction or with excuses. He's just saying, here's what it is. And then what does he do? How do they react? In verse 18, he tells them, first of all, what? Verse 18.
Hand of my God.
Okay. What's another way to put that?
God's behind us on this.
God's behind us on this. This is what God wants. This is what I'm convicted about. This is why I'm here. So the good hand of God. And remember when he had said that before, back in verse 8, after the king granted his request, according to the good hand of my God upon me, you just have to see that we're just giving a very brief summary here of what he's telling them, but you can only imagine him saying, look, the king has given me authority. I have all the resources, I have all the materials. God has worked in his providence to bring us to this point. That's why I'm here. We're going to get this done. So the good hand of God upon me, the king's words that he had spoken to me in verse 18. So, how do they respond to that?
Let us rise up and build.
Let's do it. He said it's time to take away the reproach. They're encouraged, they're enthusiastic about it now. Any other thoughts there?
Wise thing that Ezra did, and he has now inserted himself in the situation, so now it's on him as well, and he says we instead of it's your fault, it's us now, and he says that. But like any wise person will do, whenever they present a problem, he doesn't just throw it out there and say fix it. He has the solution in mind when he brings up the problem, and that's a good lesson for us today. We're part of the problem. We can be part of the solution, but we need to suggest something and not just lay the problem out there, because that's what. Mm-hmm. That's what an instigator does.
Okay. Yeah, instigators can do that. Sometimes I think you'll grant this, sometimes people who see a problem, they go to key individuals and say, okay, here's a problem, help me figure out how to solve this. And then they take it to the broader group.
And that's a wise way, and that's a wise way to handle it, because you're finding a solution, and that's exactly what Nehemiah did with God.
Exactly. Exactly. He had spent 4 months going through this, figuring it out, and you had maybe Nehemiah just planned it all out himself, but maybe he also tapped people. You know, you think about the level he was at in that government, how he could talk to people and say, here's what I am thinking about doing. We don't know. But here he is before the people. Here's the problem. Here's what I've been, you know, authorized to do. This is what I've been inspired in small I in that, inspired by God to do. This is where God has led me in my life. And let's get with it. So they respond very favorably. And one of the things that I like to notice here is that when Nehemiah is telling them and encouraging them, here's the work we have before us, is it's implied, I believe in you, and I believe you can do it. That he's giving them confidence and credit and building them up as he's saying, look, we've got this to do. There's an implication there. Do you have something, JD?
Yeah, I just came to that part, so he got it with us who can be against us.
Yes.
Because he even makes our enemies sometimes be at peace. You know?
It can. It can at times, or it can make them be really, really angry, as we're going to see unfold here, that these enemies are not happy at all about what's happening. But be that as it may. Question number four I asked, today, who can inspire others like Nehemiah? Do you have to be some great official with letters of authority and all of that? So who can do it?
Any Christian.
All right, any Christian. Let's break that down. Paul, you have something?
We have to do it together. Can't do it by yourself.
Okay, we can't do it by ourselves. It's going to take... Okay, Rick, do you have something?
That's basically...
Okay. All right, so... Say that. Someone that's ready to go and do. Yeah. You've got evangelists mentioned very specifically in the New Testament. That's a distinct role among the brethren. What other roles do you have? He gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some
elders,
pastors, right? Deacons,
teachers.
Who would fall under that category of teachers? Somebody who teaches. Yeah, somebody who knows enough to teach the word. But that could be men or women. It could be women teaching other women, women teaching younger children to encourage them. Could be women talking among themselves, the older women, or to do what with the younger? Teach the younger women, right? Titus chapter 2. So kind of to Clint's point, anybody, any child of God can do it. Any of us can serve as a catalyst to encourage others. Widows can do it. Mike?
Ashley pointed, it's also, you know, the fact that just the small things that we do, because even Jesus in Matthew 25 talks about how, you know, when I was hungry, you gave me something to eat. When I was in prison, you came to visit me. When I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. When I was naked, you gave me, you know, it's those small things of actual action that come out of the theory part of what we think, and it actually becomes action. It's where the rubber hits the road.
Mm-hmm.
When people actually do action, that means a lot.
Yes, and we're going to dig into that in just a minute, kind of that broader thing that unfolds here. But one thing I want to touch before we jump on a little bit forward here, you know, people are best inspired by encouraging words to a challenge. They need to see the need for it. They have to see the need. If they don't see the need for it, they're not going to get behind it, right? They have to believe it can be done. They have to believe they can do it. They have to believe it's the right thing. And I also am convinced they need to see it as bigger than themselves. They have to see this is a great cause. that I'm going to give myself to. All right. Now, in verses 19 and 20, as it ends up there, that section, the enemies are angry, they're upset, they ridicule, they make fun of them, which ridicule is a very powerful tool to demoralize people in what they're trying to do, to discourage them. And the enemies of God are never happy about the people of God being blessed or having an advantage or getting to work and advancing things. They're never happy. So every time we go to move forward, the devil works to counteract that. And you have to be aware that's going to happen. And you can't let that throw you off your game, because he will come after us. All right, now, how does Nehemiah respond to them? Just very briefly here. What does he tell them? Verse 20.
God of heaven will make us prosper. You don't have any right or claim or any say in this. You don't have any portion of this. It's not for you.
Who's this message for? Well, it's to the enemies. One, he's showing the enemies, you're not going to intimidate me. Don't care what you say. You're not going to intimidate me. Who else is listening to this message?
The children of God.
Those Israelites that just said, let us rise up and do it. They're hearing Nehemiah. Okay, he's not flinching. That gives him great encouragement.
And he's willing to sacrifice the peace in the area so that God's word may be done. And that is also a valuable lesson for us. We can't just not say something because it's going to hurt other people's feelings or not maintain the peace.
Yeah, don't do that because they're going to get upset. Well, if it's the right thing to do, doesn't matter, Mike.
Well, also the way he words it is you have no portion in this. Only God's children can do God's children's work.
Yes.
And we can't assign it to someone else because you look and see what happened here. Now, nothing was being done. And so, we have to do our part. We have to do what we're asked to and called to do.
Great lead into question five. When you look at 2:18 and then chapter 3 and the people, what does it teach us about the people in regard to the work? Okay, I was going to do a little thing about who wants to read chapter 3, but we don't have time, so anyway. Who all's in chapter 3? Okay, I'll give you one hint. 3 verse 1, the priest that are there, high priest and other priest. Chapter 3 verse 2, it mentions the men of Jericho. You go on down through, men of Gibeon, men of Mizpah. Chapter 3 verse 8, who does it mention? What kind of people? I'm not asking for the names. Goldsmiths and? Perfumers. They're out there working on the wall. Right? In verse 9, it talks about various leaders. Then it talks about chapter 3, verse 12, who's involved there. Very last part. He and his daughters get out there. And then you get down to verse 17, talks about Levites. Verse 32 is merchants. I love this chapter because it paints a picture. Okay, this family and these people working on this part of the wall, and next to them were these people working on this part of the wall, and next to them they worked from here to here and they did all this. And it just goes through. There's all kinds of different people with all types of different skills and backgrounds and family makeups and from different places who are there, and they're getting at it. They're doing the work that needs to be done. What does this teach us? It's work we all can do. I think we got a song or two about that, right? What is the New Testament, how does it paint the picture of the church that fits with this? It's in 1 Corinthians 12. We'll just fast forward there because
we are all members of one body.
Body. What's the body made up of?
Organs, cells, different parts.
Yeah, he talks eyes and ears and, different pieces of the body. They all don't do the same thing, but they're all valuable. They all contribute. And you can't say, well, one part of the body is better than the other.
Well, when I read through this chapter, what I saw was an organized plan. They all knew what their part was to do, and they each had their own part to do. And when they did it, it all connected.
Exactly. Exactly right. All of them have thrown themselves into this work that is being done there. And we have the charge. Let's go to Ephesians 4. We'll wrap it up here. Ephesians 4. And let's read verses 15 and 16, please. Micah, I'm going to ask you to read that. Ephesians 4, 15 and 16. Okay, that's our charge. That admonition is to us, that every part of this body does its share to build up this body. That means we're here in the Bible classes encouraging one another. We're here for the worship services. We put our hands, our hearts, our shoulders to the work, if you will, that all of us do this together, because we can't, any one of us, do it all alone. And so we see in Nehemiah how those people, those families who were committed to God, pulled together to do that work, to accomplish a great thing for God's people. And we need to believe we can do that as well. We can accomplish great things for His kingdom. Any other thoughts?
I was just going to mention, Stephen, in verse 6 of chapter 4, and I'm sure you'll get to that point and emphasize it, but it's talking about them being enjoined together, and it's an enjoined work, which of course is what we understand about the bodies fitly joined together. And it goes on and says that the people had a mind to work.
Exactly. Exactly right. This is why I love the book of Nehemiah, because it is essentially a blueprint for us in the work of the kingdom. That was a physical work which had, you know, consequences or relation to God's people as a spiritual people and serving Him. But wow, when you look at this and how much it applies to us and what lessons and encouragement we can get out of it. All right, Clint.
Just one last thing about how he answered Sanballat.
Mm-hmm.
He said, Sanballat said, "Will you rebel against the king?" He didn't even answer that. He just left it at God.
Right.
He said, "I've got letters, I've got authority, I've got this, I've got..." He didn't even say any of that.
Yeah.
He just said, "It's none of your business."
Yeah, at this point, that's exactly his answer in our common terms. None of your business, get out. Right? That's to a degree, that's exactly how we need to be. We have a work here, and somebody trying to discourage or, you know, come in and monkey with that in some way, it's our work. We're going to do it. Let's get to it. All right. Thank you all very much.